Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Podcasts of prior shows are also available at wdiy.org or on other streaming services and sites such as npr.org. Just search for Your Financial Choices. Our topic this evening is listeners' tax questions. That's you, the listener. If you have tax questions, tonight is the night to call in. The phone number is 610-758-8810. Eric is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer them. Again, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And questions can also be sent through the website at yourfinancialchoices.com. And people have also been sending me topic ideas through the website as well, and I really appreciate that. I've been doing this since 2007. I've been on WDIY since 2009. So it's been quite a while to come up with ideas every single week, and I really want to make sure that I'm providing valuable educational information to our listeners in what you would like to hear more about. So you can send topic ideas through that as well. And in fact, next week, February 16th, we're going to talk about running a business and choosing a business entity. And that was one topic that was requested by one of our listeners. So I really appreciated that. If you would like to talk live with us, you just give Eric your information and he'll, and if you don't want to, if you don't want to talk live on air, give your information to Eric. He'll write it down and he'll bring it into the studio. And if you're okay talking live on air, then we'll put you right through and you can talk live on air with me. So again, listeners, tax questions. If you have questions, the number is 610-758-8810. And we will try to do this at least a couple more times through tax season, as many of you may still be waiting for your tax forms to come in. I did have a question right before the show about, you know, having the tax documents and not having received them all yet. And that isn't the rule that they're supposed to be delivered by January 31st. And that is generally they have to be, you know, prepared, generated by January 31st. This is typically with W-2s, 1099 INTs, which is for interest, the Social Security statements, 1099 Rs. Those are fairly basic documents. What has typically taken longer now are the consolidated 1099 forms. And what I mean by that is brokerage statements. And the consolidated 1099 typically includes what might have been prepared separately years ago, where you're investing with a brokerage firm and you may have interest on your investments, you may have dividends on your investments, and you may have capital gains on investments that you may have sold or from your mutual funds. And the brokerage houses now combine those all on one 1099 they call the consolidated 1099. But when you open up that envelope and you look, you can actually see that it's still in the format of 1099 INT or 1099 DIV or 1099 B for brokerage sales, that type of thing. Those the IRS did allow extensions for. And the story behind that, I believe, is what happens is these mutual fund companies are, you know, buying and selling companies, their investments that they make. It's money managers buying and selling companies. And they have to kind of close their books on the activity for the year that they've had. And that takes some time. And what used to happen is they would quick close the books, issue that 1099 on January 31st, and then realize there was still more reconciliation to be done. And then you would get a corrected 1099, and then everybody was complaining about the corrected 1099s. So by giving those asset management companies a little bit more time to kind of close their books and get the numbers all straightened out, the hope is that you're not going to have to get corrected 1099s as much as you used to or as often as you used to. Sometimes we'd see them get corrected two times before the end of tax season. And that's just a lot of grief, trouble, time, inefficiencies, cost. So I think it's okay to wait a little bit and to get it right so that you don't have to do amended returns. So 1099 consolidated statements may be taking longer. 1099Bs, not probably so much. 1099 divs, if you just have like directly held stock. It's those mutual funds that typically kind of hold things up. K-1s, also a Schedule K-1. If you are either a partner in a partnership or a limited partner in a limited partnership or a shareholder in an S-corporation, K-1s are not required to be issued by January 31st because those returns aren't due by then. So the partnerships and S-Corps typically done, you know, maybe March 15th if they're not extended. So you might have to be a little delayed in your filing of your own personal return if you are, of interest in those types of entities. It'll take a little longer to get those. If they extend those returns, then you may end up actually extending your own return to, wait for those K-1s. We also sometimes see K-1s, Schedule K-1s, when you are a beneficiary of a trust or the beneficiary of an estate. Estates can have fiscal years, and the fiscal year could start somewhere in the middle of the year and end somewhere in the middle of the next year. And what controls the tax year that you have to report the information off that K-1 is the year end. The fiscal year end is what controls what year it goes on your return. So you might have a beneficiary of an estate who has a fiscal year that might be 2021 ending in 2022. Then you wouldn't have to report that K-1 information until 2022. Trust typically are calendar year filers, but occasionally if a trust was left by someone who has died, who may not have had an estate, the trust may make an election if they qualify to file as an estate, and therefore they can elect to use a fiscal year. There's a special election for that. It's called a 645 election. And that is often quite handy if it's just kind of like close this up. Sometimes people don't have estates anymore. They just have trust. If that trust is typically acting like an estate, then that fiscal year may be available to them. And that's where a trust may also have a fiscal year. But otherwise, trusts typically have a calendar year as well. So those are some of the documents that may come a little bit later and could delay your return. Typically, what I will say to people is if you're someone who's waiting for a K-1, maybe from like a limited partnership, an investment that you might have done, get all the rest of your information together. Get that all, put together, and that can get entered into the tax software so that when you eventually do get that K-1, you'll just have to plunk it in, boom, you'll be done. You're not going to have to wait for everything at that point. So I hope that helps. So that was really a good question from Eric, actually, at the beginning of the show about, why aren't all the tax documents in my mailbox yet? And that's some of the reasons why. So it's not just 1099s on the consolidated statements we might expect to be a little bit late, but also K-1s. A question also came in, which I'll respond to when we come back from this first break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Tonight's topic, listeners' tax questions. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Lost my voice there for a second. Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. We are taking listeners' tax questions this evening. The phone number is 610-758-8810. And you can call and talk live on air with me. Or if you're not comfortable talking live, you don't have to. You can give your question to Eric and he'll write it down and bring it in to me, which is what Beverly did. Beverly called in with a question. She has two homes, and this year they sold. There's some capital gains, and I believe she's asking about the rules on that, and does she pay capital gains, or are there other options? So Beverly, basically what happens, if you have two homes, one home I'm expecting would be your principal residence. There's rules for a principal residence. If you live in your home and own your home for at least 2 out of 5 years, there's a principal residence exclusion on the gain up to $250,000 per person. So if you have a spouse, that would be $500,000 of gain that you would not have to recognize. Now, typically when you go to sell a principal residence, they ask, or any real estate that has a home, they're going to ask you certain questions. And if they ask the questions, did you live and own the home 2 out of the last 5 years? And here's the gain, then they may not even issue a tax document to you. The tax document that's issued when they sell real estate is a 1099-S, S as in Sam. And they only report the proceeds on the sale of a residence. So one, if it's a principal residence and the gain is less than that, you don't have anything to recognize. If they give you the 1099-S, then you just put in that, you know, you sold it for, you know, $300,000, cost basis $300,000. You don't get a loss for a principal residence, a personal loss. It's not allowed. So don't recognize the gain in that scenario. Don't recognize the loss. Only report it if you get the 1099-S, or you'd only have to report it. Now, if you sold another residence, that a second home, that it was not your principal residence, meaning you did not live and own it 2 out of 5 years, it was just a second home, and you know you went there occasionally, 3 months out of the year, 4 months out of the year. You it wasn't your principal residence on your tax return or your license or your voting card. It was just a second home. Then yes, you would have to report the sale as a capital gain, and you would report it in the year that you sell it. So if you sold it in 2022, it gets reported in 2022. And what you'd want to make sure you have is the cost basis on the property. And the cost basis will be what you paid for it and potentially what other improvements you made to the property. So if you did renovate, not if you, you know, painted it and put on in a new, you know, like screwed in a new light bulb or something. I'm talking about major improvements, landscaping, a pool, a new kitchen, a new bathroom. You'd add up the cost basis of all those things. That adds to your cost basis. And if it's long-term and you had it more than a year, then it's going to be a long-term capital gain. If it's a rental property, that's a whole different story. I'm talking, what I've understood from your question, is just a second home. So there would be capital gains on that for federal and state purposes. Now, if you thought there's a you know, another option, a way to get out of that, it's probably too late, because if you already sold the home, then you're out of luck. What you might be thinking of is something called a 1031 exchange, where, and there's a lot of strict requirements on this, but some people will talk about not recognizing a gain. And what you do is you you buy another property, but it can't have an element of personal use at this point. There's all kinds of rules. It's too complicated to get into right now. If you've already sold the property, it's too late. What happens if you want to do a 1031 exchange is you have to have a qualified intermediary. You cannot take possession of the check. You have to identify another property within 45 days, and then you have to buy the other property, I believe, in within 180 days. Lots of requirements around that to avoid recognizing the gain today. Capital gain tax rates aren't too bad right now, though. So, you know, that's something to consider as well. And it has to be like kind, same kind of property. Now, Beverly, if your property was rented, then what happens is you're going to have a Schedule E rental property schedule where you would have depreciated the building. So let's pretend you paid $200,000 for it 5 years ago, and you sold it in 2022. The $200,000 is not your cost basis. Did I say sold it? You bought it for $200,000 in my story. If you bought it 5 years ago, you've depreciated it over those 5 years, and the depreciation is like probably 27 and a half years. So, and I'm going to make this up because I don't have my calculator. Let's pretend you depreciated $5,000. So your cost basis isn't $200,000, it's $195,000. And if you sell it for $395,000, now you have a $200,000 gain in that story. The proceeds are $395,000. The gain looks like $200,000, but you would have also had selling expenses. So you want to pull out that settlement sheet. And if it says you sold it for $395,000, you might have, you know, paid costs of, you know, commissions and things like that of, you know, $26,000. So your $396,000 less your commissions is $376,000 less your $195,000, you know, depreciation is your gain. And then when you typically you're going to do this with a tax preparer or through software, if you've entered the basis of the material properly in the software, it will calculate the gain and how the gain is taxed within the software, because to the extent you took depreciation, you're going to pay a different tax rate on that. It's called depreciation recapture, capped at 25%, but it's not going to be the lower long-term capital gains tax rates to the extent it was depreciation. All right. Now, Beverly, if for any reason we talked about the cost basis of the property, I said it's your home, it's improvements. If this was a rental property, it would all be included on the depreciation schedule for the rental property. Let's say, I'm going to add a twist to it. Let's say that you inherited this and your parent had been renting it. Then it would get a step up in basis to the date of death value. So that's one little nuance of understanding what the cost basis is. But otherwise, if you've used software to do the rental property, it should all be in the software, and you enter the sale price, you enter the selling expenses, look at the settlement sheet. It should kind of calculate it and tax it accordingly. So I hope that helped. And there was a lot packed into that. So hopefully that'll help a lot of other people too. I'm always surprised that some people still think that there's old rules about taking your principal residence in the gain and rolling it into your next house, the tax situation. That's a really old laws. Suzanne from Bethlehem also called and asked the question, if you work from home, how much household expenses can you deduct? And I'll talk about that when we come back from this next break, Suzanne. So hang on while we do that, and I will talk about home office expenses, and it might not be what you think compared to what it used to be. Rules have changed. Folks, if you have questions, I love it. I love these calls are coming in. Listeners' tax questions is our topic. The phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Psst! Did you know that your phone is a radio? You can tune in to WDIY anywhere on the go with WDIY's phone app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store, and your phone will become your trusted radio. The easy-to-use app lets you listen to WDIY on your phone live and access your favorite music shows on demand. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to Many Choices, Real Voices.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. We are taking listeners' tax questions this evening. Phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can just call in. Eric's here. You can write down the question and bring it in to me. Suzanne had called from Bethlehem and had asked, if you work from home, how much household expenses can you deduct? Well, Suzanne, that's also one of those little packed questions. So, you know, if the rules have changed a bit, okay? So with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of, 2017, they took away miscellaneous itemized deductions, and they raised the standard deduction. So many people are no longer itemizing deductions anyway, and they took away the miscellaneous itemized deduction, which is where a home office came into play if you are a W-2 employee. So typically when someone says, I'm working from home, how much household expenses I can take, I'm typically thinking that you're an employee and you're working from home. So those kinds of deductions are gone for federal purposes. They are still available for Pennsylvania purposes as a deduction, which we complete on the UE form, which is unreimbursed employee business expenses for Pennsylvania. But there's certain rules that we have to follow, though, which is, are you required to work from home? So if you are required to work from home, then you may be able to take some deductions for a home office. If you pay rent, and the form for federal used to be the 2106. And as I mentioned, for Pennsylvania, it's the form UE. There's things like rent, or utilities. If you own the home, then you would have real estate taxes or mortgage interest and, utilities. But it's limited to the space that you're using for dedicated work. So not your living room couch. Is the space actually, exclusive use for business purposes? And the underlying expenses. Now, if you have a separate home office, I have an office in my home that I have worked in for years, and I take no deductions because my employer also has an office for me. There's no reason I have to have an office at home. There's no requirement that I have one at home. Sometimes we'll see salesmen who have to have an office and home, and that is typically where we would use the Form 2106 to reflect all those expenses and then take it as a miscellaneous itemized deduction on Schedule A if you itemize. So sometimes those people weren't even getting a benefit anyway. Now with the higher standard deduction and eliminating the miscellaneous itemized deductions, you're not getting it for federal at all. For Pennsylvania, you still might get it. But it's the expenses you'd typically have. You can go through that on the Form UE for Pennsylvania. But typically it's, you know, the square footage that's used for exclusive use over the total square footage. And it's mortgage interest, real estate taxes, the homeowner's insurance, you know, utilities, the expenses that you would expect. Federal years ago. Now, let's say you're a Schedule C sole proprietor, Suzanne. If you're that, now it's a whole different story because now it's not a Form 2106. Oh, gosh, the other form escapes me. But it's the form that goes with the Schedule C. If you have a home office, then you could get that deduction. And you also could get depreciation for the percent of your home that you're using for that exclusive home office use. And that becomes a deduction on your Schedule C, and that also then would tie into your Schedule C for your state return as well. Now, in that situation, if you're self-employed and you have a Schedule C, then there is some options. You can take an alternative deduction for a home office, which is just a fixed dollar amount for the square footage, and still take a deduction for your real estate taxes and mortgage interest on Schedule A if you want. But the deduction for the alternative deduction, the simplified method, they call it. And in 2020, it was $5 per square foot of exclusive use, but capped at 300 square feet. So it was a $1,500 deduction. But Pennsylvania, if you're a Pennsylvania resident, they don't recognize that. So, you know, what I try to remind people that if you're not going to get it for federal and you think you're going to get a deduction for Pennsylvania, and Suzanne, again, back in the scenario, if you're an employee and your employer requires you to work from home and you get this deduction, and some employers, I think, did allow that through the pandemic. If you're preparing your own return, it's one thing for you to go through that deduction, but I'm telling you, if you're asking a CPA to go through that with you, unless you're super organized, sometimes that calculation and putting all that information into the tax return costs more in preparation fee than you're going to save in taxes. So Suzanne, think about that for a minute. If you're going to save $40 on that deduction for Pennsylvania purposes, and it's going to cost the tax preparer $50 or $100 or $60 to do the calculation for you, to enter all of that information, the real estate tax, the mortgage interest, the square footage, the depreciation, the utilities, then it might not even be worth it. And that's what you might want to think about. So for Schedule C, it probably could be worth it. But for you as an employee, may not be worth it. Crunch the numbers. All right. So I hope that helps. I hope that helps. And by the way, I love the IRS website. Some people, oh gosh, the IRS. The IRS has lots of information. So you can go on irs.gov if, Suzanne, you think this might qualify for you, like if you are a Schedule C sole proprietor. And Pennsylvania has the same thing. PA Department of Revenue has, you know, similar resources. But for the IRS, you can go on irs.gov. They have a search box and you can just search for things there. You can say Schedule C, you can say home office, and you can find information that is, you know, really coming from the source. For example, in preparing for the show tonight, I thought, well, what's changed? What has changed from 2021? What could I, you know, mention to our listeners if I don't have listeners calling in with their tax questions? And I came up, I went to a publication, which I'll talk about when we come back from, you know, the halfway break, a publication 17, and it reminded me when I first started in taxes and working at a CPA firm. ages ago. I mean, we kept these publications at our desk. The publication 17 was something I was referencing constantly. So it was really fun to go in there. Well, fun for me to go in there and print to PDF the publication 17. It made me feel like, you know, nostalgic to the old paper that we used to have at our hands. And it talks about the changes. So I'm gonna go over that. Now, there was one other question that I had at the beginning of the show from someone that had said, hey, I already filed my return and oops, I got another document that I completely forgot about. Think about it. Sometimes we did something in January of 2021 and we completely forgot because we don't even, you know, we've all lost track of time lately. What am I going to do? I've already filed. Well, what you're going to do if you've already filed and you get a tax document, first thing you're going to look at is to see if it really even impacts the return. If it's $10, the IRS doesn't care. If it's $25, the IRS doesn't care. If it's $3,000, the IRS is going to care. You're going to have to wait for your return to kind of get through the system, and then you're going to amend the return. You just have the preparer or the software, you open it up, you say you want to amend the return, or your preparer will do it and enter the new information. Everything populates. It inputs the changes. You pay what's due if you miss something, and you're going to have to amend for federal and state if that's applicable. All right. So you'd have to wait. You can't just go in and change the return. It would really mess up the IRS. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Good evening, WDIY Allentown. The time is now 6:30. And Lehigh Valley weather tonight is going to be low 32. Thursday is going to be a slight chance of snow and rain, high 46. Thursday night is going to be low around 26. And for your Friday, we're going to be sunny, high 49. Friday night, low around 39. And Saturday, you're going to have high 55, partly sunny. And Saturday night, low 25. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Shandi. Welcome back, folks. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Eric. He'll write it down and bring it in to me. You could also send questions through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. So we are talking about listeners' tax questions, and I mentioned before the break a publication that really it's called Your Federal Income Tax. And if you go on IRS.gov, go to the search box and type in Publication 17 PDF, a PDF option comes up, and you can print it to PDF, and it has basically, you know, all the information you might need to prepare your individual income tax return. And if it's not in there, they'll give you direction where to get it. There are publications for absolutely everything. And there's a publication for, you know, child credits. There's publications for farms. There's publications for rental properties. There's publications for businesses. You can get a publication that has a lot of detail in whatever endeavor you might have or need that additional information. So, and for example, like Suzanne asked maybe about a home office, that home office information might be available in like the business publication, the Schedule C business publication, but they also have pretty detailed instructions on the forms themselves. So if you know what form to file, like I mentioned, the Form 2106, which is on reimbursed employee business expenses, which is kind of, you know, it will come back in 2026 when the sunset, the tax law sunset, but you can use that, and I think it might still be available anyway to support state returns. So Publication 17 is called Your Federal Income Tax, and the first thing they have in the publication is a section called What's New, or, you know, highlight types of things. And they mentioned that the due date of, so I'm going to go through some of those. But again, if you have questions, the topic is listeners' tax questions tonight. So I'm happy to, you know, interrupt myself and take your questions. The phone number is 610-758-8810. So the due date is April 18th this year. And you might ask why the 18th, because the 15th is on a Friday. And it's because of something called Emancipation Day. So the due date of the returns is going to be April 18th. And Maine and Massachusetts, a due date is April 19th, and that's because they have some special state holiday as well. Some of the things that have changed, one of the education credits, and again, sometimes they do updated tax legislation and, you know, may change, but as of this publication, they are mentioning that the tuition and fees deduction is no longer available after 2020. However, the income limitation for the lifetime learning credit were increased. So the income limitations were increased, so more people will qualify for the lifetime learning credit. That's an education credit. It's great. It could be for, you know, after the American Opportunity Credit doesn't apply anymore. It could be for grad school or just extra education, making sure it's qualified. So more people will qualify for that. And that's a nice deduction. Your income has to be below a certain limitation as well. We have a caller, Carolyn from Sailorsburg. Hi, Carolyn. It's Lori. Can you hear me, Carolyn? Well, we might have lost Carolyn. Do tax preparers need all the receipts when preparing IRS for nonprofit? So Carolyn's question relates to charitable contributions, I believe. And does the tax preparer need all of the receipts when preparing the return as support for the return? No, Carolyn, we don't, but you do. So it is the responsibility of the taxpayer to have all of the support for their tax return. And typically, tax documents like a W-2 and a 1099, the tax preparer definitely needs, because there's a lot of important information on those documents that they need to electronically file. So the employer identification number, the withholdings, all of that information is critical. So there are certain documents we want to make sure we're matching with the IRS. So things like W-2s and income documents are reported to the IRS. So when we do your tax return, we have to make sure they match. Things like charitable contributions, real estate taxes, medical expenses, those aren't reported to the IRS. Those are like self-reporting types of, deductions. But you need to keep the receipts in case you're audited. So the IRS does require us to have a written receipt for monetary donations of $250 or more. A receipt can also, for under that amount, can be checks, can be a written receipt, can be a charge card statement. But for $250 or more, you should have a receipt from the organization to whom you made the donation. But you can keep that. So if you told me, for example, for 2021, if you're single and you don't itemize, you can take a $300 deduction off page one, we call it, off your ordinary income. You can, if you're married, you can take a $600 deduction for monetary donations, not for goodwill or, you know, personal property or used clothing. I'm talking about monetary donations. If you're not itemizing, are above the line deduction, $300 for single, $600 for married, family, and joint. You need to have your receipt for that. Keep it in your records. Keep it in your tax folder. I don't need it. Tax preparers don't need it. It's only if you're audited do you need it. All right. If you are itemizing your deductions, then you can also take those other non-monetary donations. If they're under $500, you took a couple bags to the Goodwill, you can just report that as usual on the Schedule A if you're itemizing. If your non-monetary donations exceed $500, you have to do a special form called a Form 8283. On that document, you have to name the charity, the address of the charity, and what you donated and the thrift shop value, basically. So if you took 10 truckloads to all these organizations of non-monetary donations and you got a slip for each of them, you will have to keep that. You have to make a note of what you donated because you have to document that on the Form 8283. That non-monetary donation total, along with other cash donations or, you know, appreciated stock or whatever else you might have donated, gets reported on Schedule A and is part of the itemized deductions. And you have to have receipts for all of that as well. So I hope that helps. Keep those on hand in case you're ever audited. But no, you don't have to provide them to the preparer. It's typically why preparers ask questions. Typically, they'll have, our CPA firms will have a questionnaire that they give out to their clients. And they'll ask such things as, did you make any charitable contributions? And if so, do you have receipts to prove that? And if you answer yes, then that's taken the burden off the preparer, you know, that you have acknowledged that you have the receipts. We're not making these numbers up. I know one time I had someone say to me, I said, you know, did you have any charitable contributions? And they said, yeah, what's the number I can do? I said, there is no number you can do. It's whatever you donated. You know, what were your actual donations? Well, I don't know. What do they say I could do? No, it doesn't work like that. It's actual donations. And then another time someone said, you know, oh, it was $3,000. And I thought, that's just too convenient. And do you have receipts for that? And, you know, if a taxpayer is signing off on the tax return under penalties of perjury, you know, that they have the backup for all the information on their return, they better make sure they have it. That's my position on that. So thank you for that call, Carolyn, and I hope that helped. Again, folks, if you have questions, phone number 610-758-8810. So some other good information on the publication 17 on the IRS's website, irs.gov, talking about the economic income payment. This is really important, people. The economic income payment, many of us called it the stimulus payment, that you might have received is not taxable income. A lot of people will ask that question, is this taxable? No, it's not taxable. The amount you received in 2021, which was about March or April, was based on either your 2019 tax return, if you hadn't filed your 2020, or based on your 2020 return, looking at the income on those returns. So if you were within the income limitations that they set for that, you might have gotten that economic income payment or the stimulus payment back in March or April. If your income was above the thresholds, then you wouldn't have qualified for it, and or you might have qualified for some of it, a partial payment. So if in 2021 you go to your tax return and your income is lower than what it had been, then you might actually get the balance of that stimulus payment, because the stimulus payment, though it was based on your 2020 or 2019 income, it really is supposed to be based on your 2021 income. So now someone will say, well, my income was way too high and in 2020 it was really low. So do I have to pay it back if they gave it to me? No, you don't have to pay it back. So if in 2020 your income was, you know, let's pretend you're single and your income was $50,000 and you got the stimulus payment, and now in 2021 your income's $150,000, you really hit it big, you're not going to qualify for the stimulus payment under 2021 numbers. You do not have to pay it back. Let's talk about the opposite. In 2020, let's say your income was $150,000 and you're single. And in 2021, you're retired and now your income is, you know, $40,000. Well, you didn't qualify for it in 2020 based on those, or you didn't qualify in March or April based on your 2020 income. But now your 2021 income is lower. Now you can qualify for it. But the only way you're going to get it is by filing the tax return and going through a worksheet for what we call now the recovery rebate credit. Similar to last year, for people who didn't get the prior year stimulus, we could do this extra calculation called the recovery rebate credit. And so if you qualify, if you either only got a partial payment in March or April, and the payment was $1,400 per person. So if you only got a partial payment or didn't get the payment, you want to do your recovery rebate credit worksheet for your 2021 tax return, and you can either get the rest of the payment or all of it, depending on where your income lies. Now, think about this, though. If your income's already too high and you didn't get it last year and you know your income's too high this year, don't bother doing anything. You just don't get it. This is really for those people who are kind of in that in-between. So for example, my son was like a dependent in the prior year. In 2021, he's not a dependent. So when he files his 2021 tax return, he'll be eligible for that recovery rebate credit that he did not get the stimulus payment in the prior year. So circumstances can change. So keep that in mind. I think that's big. And that was big last year. I mean, I was really tracking down those stimulus payments for people and just try to figure out if you got it. Now, one other little caveat on that. I had a client who received a partial stimulus payment, let's say in March. We hadn't filed her 2020 return yet. They based it on 2019. She only qualified for some of it. Well, then when we filed her 2020 return, the government squared up with her, and then she got the balance of her stimulus payment. She got the total $1,400, but in two different increments because they squared up with a lot of people after they filed their 2020 return. So you might think you only got a partial. You might have gotten the whole thing. You might have to go check your bank account. I don't know if they're sending letters out for that this year. I know they're sending out letters for the advanced child tax credit, but not sure about the economic income payments. I think they talked about it, but I'm yet to have anybody tell me they got one. Folks, we are on the last quarter of the show. Appreciate the questions. Tonight's topic is listeners' tax questions. If you have any, you're welcome to call. The phone number is 610-758-8810. You can also send them through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. We are taking listeners' tax questions this evening. Phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me or give your question to Eric. He'll write it down and bring it in to me. I do want to mention something that I brought up last week on our recorded show last week, which was for if you cannot afford tax preparation, there are resources that may provide preparation for free. Some of that information is available on the IRS's website. Just, you know, go to irs.gov, search in the box, say free file or e-file free, and they'll give you the resources there. And one other resource, which might also be included there, but Carol Eisenbeis was, what do I want to say? I was going to say sweet enough to call or to send me an email and let me know. She's the District 22 coordinator for the AARP Foundation Tax Aid Service, and she wrote in with some helpful information for free tax assistance. Go online to the AARP Foundation Tax Aid Locator, and they'll give you locations available near your zip code, and you can call 1-888-227-7669. You'll be asked to enter your zip code and you will be given the same information that's on the site. You don't have to be an AARP member, but they are limited in scope. The tax aid cannot prepare returns for self-employed individuals. Or those who have a loss, who have employees, or who have depreciable items. Any not-for-profit income, rental income, farm income, or those with complicated capital gains are K-1. So I thought that was nice, and also no virtual currency. They have 8 of their 10 sites open. So I think that I wanted to make sure I mentioned that, because she was so kind to write in and let us know that and remind us of that for people who can't afford to pay for tax preparation. Greg from Bethlehem called in. Interest on the tax return, $3 or $4. Will they get a 1099? Have not received it yet. Is the amount too small? Great question, Greg. Correct. If you earned under $10 on a bank account, for example, if it's under $10, they are not required to report it. It doesn't even move the needle on your tax return. So no, they do not report it. You know, if someone tells me they have $3, I'll put it on their tax return, but it's not even going to change the tax on $3. But correct, you will not get a 1099 if it's less than $10 from your bank. Good question. Some people wait for that and they think it's, you know, that they need that for the tax return. Nope. So good. Thank you for that question. Let me see what else we had on that publication 17 that is, you know, some new items that I think are important to mention. That there's expanded dependent care assistance and child tax credits. So people, you know, sometimes we get so used to doing our returns like same as last year. We call it Sally, same as last year. And we don't, like, you know, look at it with fresh eyes or think about it in a new way or ask these questions. You may have thought you didn't qualify for something before, and maybe things have changed and you do. If you're using software, quite easily the software can help you catch these things. If you're self-preparing, yes, some people still do their tax returns with paper and pencil or pen, then you may miss some of these items. If you're using software out of the box, then it usually will catch it as well. So there is expanded dependent care assistance and child tax credits. The American Rescue Plan expanded the child and dependent care tax credit for 2021 by making it refundable for certain taxpayers and making it larger. They did not used to be refundable. For 2021, the dollar limit on qualifying expenses increases to $8,000 for one qualified person. It used to be six. And $16,000 for two for more qualifying persons. The rules for calculating the credit have also changed. The percentage of qualifying expenses eligible for the credit has increased, along with the income limit at which the credit begins phasing out. So more people will benefit from that child tax credit. You know, the cost of child care is just astronomical. So this is, you know, a really nice benefit for people who have high child care costs. Taxpayers who receive dependent care benefits from their employer, the dollar limit of the exclusion amount increases for 2021. There's more information on instructions for the child care dependent care credit for Form 2441 or Publication 503. The child tax credit, also under the American Rescue Plan, the child tax credit has also been enhanced for 2021. The child tax credit has been extended to qualifying children under the age of 18. It used to be under the age of 17. So it's nice. So people get a nice little extra boost if you qualify, if your income is within those ranges, depending on your modified adjusted gross income. Now, you may receive an enhanced credit amount of up to $3,600 for a qualifying child under age 6 and up to $3,000 for a qualifying child over age 5 and under age 18. The enhanced credit amount begins to phase out where modified adjusted gross income exceeds $150,000 on a joint return or a surviving spouse, $112,500 for head of household, and $75,000 in all other cases. So that's the enhanced piece that phases out. The regular credit, I mean, they raised the limitation for the regular credit to, you know, really quite high amounts, you know, in the prior year. So many more people qualify for the child tax credit that didn't used to. It's the enhanced credit that has those lower thresholds. Now, some people got an advance credit, and you should be receiving a letter if you did get the advance credit. The letter is has a number on it. It's number 6419. It'll tell you what the advance credit was. Now, I think I heard someone in my office say that the letters weren't exactly right. So make sure that you cross-reference it with the actual amounts that you received. Maybe, you know, you had one child or two children or whatever, and it could have gotten a little messed up. Cross-reference it with what you received against the letter. If you're preparing your return, you have to enter those amounts. There's a schedule to reconcile these amounts. It's Schedule 8812, and you'll have to know what you received to know what the remaining credit would be on your tax return, or if you're eligible for it. If they gave you an advance credit and your income is over the threshold, then you may have to pay it back. Now, one way you can try to manage your income on the return, if you're in that situation, if you have wages and you're eligible to do a deductible traditional IRA, you might be able to manipulate the taxable income, the page one income, a little bit to maybe massage the availability of the advance credit so that you're not having to pay it back. I haven't played with those numbers, so I don't know if I'm way out of line on that, but it's just, you know, there's other opportunities there that you might be able to control that. Here's something for the premium tax credit. The premium tax credit is if you went on the marketplace or penny.com to get your health insurance and you qualified maybe for an advance credit. So if your health insurance and premiums were going to cost you, you know, $400 a month or $600,000 or $600 a month or $1,000 a month, and your income is below a certain threshold, you may have qualified for an advance credit. So my example, $1,000 health insurance premium, my income's low, I'm going to qualify for, let's say, a $400 advance credit. I'm only paying $600 a month for my insurance. If now I go to do my tax return, they have taken away, they've eliminated the household income limitation to 400% of the federal poverty line, and they have generally increases the credit amount. So they've increased the credit amount, so people who might have had to pay some of it back may not have to. That's one thing. But the big note that I just read today, love the publication, if you receive unemployment compensation in 2021, you're generally eligible to claim the premium tax credit and wouldn't have to pay it back. So that's my quick understanding of how that works. That is huge. Earned income credit, you know, you have to make very low income to be eligible for this. But if you're claiming the credit without having a child, typically we think about the earned income credit available for someone who's out working and has, you know, a child, then you may qualify for a bigger credit. But even if you don't have a child, you still may be eligible for what is called the earned income credit if your income's low enough. The minimum age has been lowered to age 19. Except for specified students who must be at least age 24 at the end of the year. So they don't want students who are working to qualify for this earned income credit, but maybe, you know, you graduated, you're not going to college, you're out there doing the grind, working, you may qualify for this earned income credit. There's rules that you have to make sure that you follow, but the credits have been increased and the phase out income limits have been expanded. So that is something to check out. Virtual currency, everyone has to answer this question now. Were you engaged in a transaction involving virtual currency? The IRS is going to be all over this. They're going to be watching this stuff. And it's funny, I saw something about, you know, they just recovered billions of dollars of virtual currency that was part of a ransom back in 2016. And, you know, I don't remember the details, but some big guy who does virtual currency said, oh, yeah, now, you know, you'll see this is really good and this is going to be make a comeback virtual currency. I'm thinking The people lost billions of dollars since 2016. That's been 5 years. It took 5 years to recover that. What does that do for people who lose their virtual currency for 5 years? Is it really making a comeback? How did you do for 5 years? So be careful of virtual currency, but that's why the IRS is tracking this stuff. They want to know what's going on. And, you know, the people who... you know, might be using it for nefarious purposes. All taxpayers are also now eligible for... Oh, and by the way, you have to answer the question yes or no if you were engaged in any transaction of virtual currency. You have to answer yes or no. If you were involved in transactions, then you do have to report them. All taxpayers are now eligible for identity protection PIN. Beginning in 2021, the IRS identity protection PIN. It's an opt-in program and has been expanded to all taxpayers who can properly verify their identity. An IP PIN helps prevent your Social Security number from being used to file a fraudulent federal income tax return. You can use the Get an IP PIN tool on IRS.gov to request an IP PIN. File Form 15227 if your income is $72,000 or less, or make an appointment to visit a taxpayer assistance center. Now, they will issue you a new PIN each year. It changes for every time you file your tax return. That's to try to help. Think about dual authentication when you're using passwords. Same kind of thing the IRS is trying to do to help protect your identity from fraudsters trying to file tax returns, claiming refunds, using your information. Folks, I ran out of time to talk about some of all the other things I wanted to talk about. So next week, we are going to have a guest, Tom Riddle, CPA, CFP professional, and we're going to talk about running a business and choosing the entity type. So we'll do that next week. And then the following week, I'll do another show of listeners' tax questions to finish some of the topics we've talked about and to answer more questions that you have. But next week, we'll talk about running a business. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. I want to thank Eric and Shondi and our listeners so much. You really make the show work. Thank you for being all here tonight. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.